You are listening to 91.9 FM WUOT, Knoxville. I'm Chrissy Kuiper, and this is Dialogue. Yesterday, an historic election took place, and a new federal administration is in the works. Of the many policies that could see a lot of change, one is the nation's energy policy. Today, my guest is Dr. Stephen Smith. He's the executive director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. He's here to outline the major issues regarding our energy policy and our climate, and to discuss how the outcome of yesterday's election could impact those issues. We'll also talk about how Tennessee fits into the big picture of energy policy and about what policy changes could mean for the state. And of course, we'll take your calls. So join us for the discussion. Join us for dialogue.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage.
I'm Chrissy Kuiper, and this is Dialogue. Well, the results are in. The election is finally over, and in January we can expect the advent of a brand new federal administration. It's probable that we'll see some changes in policy in this country, and energy policy and the green economy are undoubtedly among the issues to be addressed. My guest today on Dialogue is Dr. Stephen Smith. He's the executive director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Dr. Smith also currently serves as co-chair on the board for the U.S. Climate Action Network, on the board for the Alliance for Climate Protection, and on the list, and the list of his current activities goes on and on and on. Dr. Smith's long experience as a spokesperson on energy issues has led to his past service on the Tennessee Valley Authority's Regional Resource Stewardship Council, on the U.S. Department of Energy's Tennessee Valley Electric System Advisory Committee, and on the National Governing Board for the Center for Resource Solutions National Green Power Accreditation. Today, he's here to discuss energy issues and policy with us, and he'll be taking your calls as well. Stephen, it's nice to meet you. Welcome to Dialogue.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. It's a historic day, so it's great that we had set this up, and I look forward to it.
Me too. Let's see. Well, that was a pretty long and impressive list of activities, so why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and about what you do?
Well, I'm the executive director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and we're a regional nonprofit energy policy and environmental advocacy organization that does work throughout the Southeast United States, primarily in five states: Tennessee, North and South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. And we have staff and offices in all those states. Our headquarters, to a large degree, is here in Knoxville. We have a long history here in Knoxville going back 25 years working on energy issues. I have been at the Alliance since 1993, when I graduated from vet school in 1992 here at the University of Tennessee. So I'm a vet school grad, veterinary medicine, and have been in Knoxville now approaching 20 years, and love East Tennessee. And it's a great position to have. Our organization has grown tremendously, and I think we've grown both in our staff and our influence. And I think the elections yesterday are an opportunity to really see a lot of the things that we've been working for a long time come to fruition.
So what has the Alliance been up to? What do you do?
Well, what our primary work is we are trying to look at how to reduce the environmental footprint of how we produce and consume energy in this country. And a long part of our history has been focused at the utility sector. We have a long history of working with TVA on some innovative programs like their Green Power Switch program, like initiatives on energy efficiency, like cleaning up their coal-fired power plants. We've also opposed them on certain things about expanding certain power plants and expanding nuclear power options in their service territory. We've done that now starting in about 2000. We went beyond the bounds of the Tennessee Valley Authority and have been intervening and being part of a lot of the policy discussions in other southern states with other utilities like Southern Company, Duke Energy, Florida Power and Light. And we go in and we work with elected officials. We work with decision makers, regulators, say public service commissions in other states. I have had the good fortune to be appointed by Governor Mark Sanford in South Carolina to be on his advisory committee for state actions on climate change. North Carolina has a legislative commission like that I was appointed to. And then Governor Charlie Crist in Florida has set up a climate action team, which I serve on the group that is working on energy supply and demand. So we get in, work with policymakers, and then we also work in the regulatory, and then we also educate people. We have a a website, cleanenergy.org, which anybody can go to. I encourage people to track what we're doing. We're in the process of revamping that to make it much more interactive with our people who are interested in our work, and that'll be taking place over the next month or so. And we also have an innovative thing that we're doing where we produce biodiesel from waste grease in Atlanta and sell it to Emory University. We're now in partnership with the University of Tennessee, which will be bringing one of those production units here to Knoxville in the next couple of months. And so we not only do the policy side, but I have a real commitment to saying, look, I want to every single day see that we're reducing tons out of the air of these emissions, and we want to do this as a social enterprise for the nonprofit.
So at the same time that you're serving on commissions and whatnot, does the organization itself lobby legislature, or do you just sort of go in from the standpoint of working with the utilities and serving on these different committees?
We do both. We have as a nonprofit 501c3, we can do a limited amount of lobbying, and then we have what's called a 501c4, which allows you more lobbying, which is called the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy Action Fund, and we can actually endorse certain candidates and others in that process. So we have both, and we do both. I mean, we do work on targeted pieces of legislation where appropriate, but most of what we're doing is educating and trying to provide information.
Okay. Well, now I read actually that you received some training under former U.S. Vice President Al Gore on presenting the topic of global warming to groups of people around the world. What was that training like, and how did it, I guess, how was it different from anything else that you've learned in your, you've been in this for a long time, so.
Right. Former Vice President Gore, over the years of his service, collected slides and did work and met with researchers and scientists and developed a slideshow. That slideshow became the basis for his documentary, Inconvenient Truth, which, to its credit, I think has been a very important educating tool to get people not only in this country but around the world tuned in to the real challenges and dangers of global warming. After he had completed the documentary, he decided that he wanted to train 1,000 citizens from around the world on the slides where they could go out and use them. And I had the good fortune of being one of the people that was selected to do that and went to Nashville and spent a couple of days with him, with a group of other folks. It was, we had close to 100 people in the class or something that I was in. And he literally went through each slide and talked through it and talked about the scientific basis, gave the sort of underpinnings for that, and then turned us loose to go out and share those slides. And I've done presentations around the region using his slides. We had developed our own show, but his slides, because of sort of the breadth and the sophistication that he had, really added to our work. And so that was very positive. And so we continue to work with him. You mentioned that I'm on the advisory board for the Alliance for Climate Protection, which has set up the WE campaign. People have seen the ads about the WE campaign and other things like that. So I have the good fortune of working with that time to time, and I think it's a valuable and important exercise because we must address global warming.
Do the slides help bring the message across a little more than it normally does when you go out and you speak to groups? Or?
I think definitely, because there are clear slides of taking, say, glaciers on land and taking pictures in the late 1800s or 1920s or whatever, and then showing where they are now, showing like the top of Kilimanjaro and seeing how that's going away, Seeing real clear examples all over the world of where we're changing our climate and we're destabilizing our climate. And there's a lot of scientific evidence from where the ice cores and others have been put together that can sort of go back and show. And it gives a visual representation to what is a fairly complicated scientific topic. And it helps people, I think, relate better because they can see this is no longer a theoretical. I mean, you can go places now in the world and see very clear examples of where we are transforming the face of the earth, and we're diminishing the planet for future generations because of the way we produce and consume energy. I mean, that's basically what it comes back to, which is very close to my core work, my career.
Sure, reducing the carbon footprint. Well, let's go ahead and open up the phone lines. If you have a question or a comment for Stephen, give us a call at 974-5050. Okay, so energy policy is a pretty broad topic, but as we were talking about before the show, just about every policy that we have and a lot of our economy, it stems from energy policy. So why don't we talk about that a little bit? What generally, starting, I guess, at a country level and a world level,
right?
Where are we?
Well, I think that what I would want to do is step back and reflect on the election. You know, last night I stayed up late and was very moved by what happened, literally moved to tears to see that Senator Obama was successful. All the historic realizations that manifest. I mean, the fact that first African-American, you know, he's literally just a year older than I am for him to be president of the United States, to see how he ran his campaign and to see all the energy and hopes and everything that were manifest out there. If you think back on the election, there were a handful of really important issues. Clearly, the economy, the war in Iraq, you know, our Middle East involvement there. Healthcare was a big part, and you know, he talked about global warming. Both candidates did, and basically, what I would argue is that for the economy, for Middle East policy, and for global warming, they all come back to energy policy. And so Senator Obama has a very forward-looking energy policy. Energy was highly debated during the election. And I think that his winning, I think, sets us on a new course. And so when you look at how we've dealt with energy policy over the last few decades, I mean, one of the central things, let's talk about our addiction to oil. Mm. I mean, you can go back to the early 1970s, the Nixon administration, the Ford administration, the Carter administration, and there was a focus on that. There was a lot of discussion. And there was a realization that we were becoming more dependent on foreign oil, and we had the experiences with the oil embargoes in the early 70s and late 70s. And this country began to adopt energy policies. We set up CAFE standards, which increased the efficiency in cars. We talked about ways to set up things like the Strategic Petroleum Reserve so we wouldn't be so readily manipulated. But if you really look at it in the 1980s and through the 1990s, and this is both Republican and Democratic administrations, we kind of went to sleep. And many of the gains that we made during those times, we lost, and we became more and more dependent on foreign oil.
Were we asleep just because of the profits that we were pulling in, or what? What do you
Well,
think
I think it was a combination of the people who were elected. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan did not make energy policy a central piece of his, and he sort of actually belittled some of the things that Carter had done, and you know, really walked away from a lot of those commitments. And then the Saudis became a dominant force in oil production, and they drove the prices very low. And we really had a long run of relatively low prices. Now that's changed, and with China entered the market, and a bunch of the international developments with China and energy becoming and commodity prices becoming much. We saw this summer, we saw prices run back up, and we've seen them running up consistently. The Clinton administration didn't do enough on this. I mean, they started out early in their administration with the concept of what they called the BTU tax, but they quickly retreated from that. And then, you know, they did a number of sort of voluntary things, but they weren't aggressive in doing it. And I think we've wasted two decades, literally. But we've got to get off of foreign oil. I mean, that's the biggest thing, not only because of the national security implications. I am a very firm believer that the reason we're in Iraq is because of the U.S. strategic interests. Those strategic interests are largely oil and who controls oil, because Iraq is second to Saudi Arabia in the reserves. We're there for that reason. All the other reasons have fallen apart in a lot of ways, and you've seen sort of the truth come out about our involvement there. And so if we can wean ourselves off of addiction to foreign oil, most of the people who have most of the oil in the world right now are not friendly to the United States, so there's huge national security implications. But there's a new now dominant reason we need to get off oil, and that's because of the carbon content of oil and the fact that we are destroying the planet. So when you couple the economic interest that we send $700 million or more a day overseas, the fact that we have these national security interests, and now we have these global climate change interests, the fact we're destabilizing our climate because of our addiction to oil, we can't wait any longer.
Right.
And so this is why I think Obama's position, this is why I think we need a new, fresh approach to doing this. Now, to the Bush administration's credit, working with Congress over the last couple of years, they've instituted some fairly ambitious renewable fuel options, looking at things like ethanol and cellulosic ethanol and biodiesel. All these are the things that are going to fuel changing the way that we are addicted to oil. Those are good starts. But you heard very much in Obama's position, and even to some degree in John McCain's position, that we've got to invest in electric vehicles. We've got to get our efficiency standards up. We passed recently a modest increase in automobile efficiency standards. Obama's talking about now let's get up to 150 miles a gallon as opposed to just focusing on moving from 27 to 37 in 10 years. if we start bringing on plug-in hybrids that can actually go 40, 50 miles on electric charge, then they go to an energy-efficient engine that is using biofuels or something like that, we can reach 150 miles a gallon to the petroleum component of fuels. These are the types of things, this is the vision, this is the leadership that we need, and with that are going to come big investments. They're going to come new, what we call green-collar jobs. Mm-hmm. A green-collar job is a job that pays a living wage, but also does something that's going to transform the environment, whether it be going in and retrofitting homes for energy efficiency, whether it's going in and retooling Detroit or other automobile manufacturers. We've got a lot of automobile manufacturers here in Tennessee. Retooling them to where they're more electric or plug-in electric hybrids or very clean diesel engines that are running on biodiesel. There's lots of jobs in that. Tennessee can take advantage of that. Our country can take advantage of that. That is going to be what's going to be a major part of the economic stimulus package we anticipate in order to dig ourselves out of this hole we're in as we're in a recession now. We need to find good green-collar jobs that do a myriad of things. We quit sending money overseas. We quit destroying the planet with global warming. And we quit sending our soldiers, our finest, over to die in Iraq and the Middle East over trying to protect our strategic interest, i.e. our addiction to oil. So we need to basically make those investments. Here is a great opportunity to do this. I think we have a leader that is transformative that can do that. All of us need to rally around this leader and really embrace that. Get ourselves out of the recession, find a solution to global warming, and finally end our addiction to oil. That is a tremendous challenge that I think we have an opportunity to do, and I think we're on the verge of moving rapidly in that direction.
Two questions I have related to that. First, again, the phone number, if you have a question for Stephen Smith, is 974-5050. Okay, I guess the first one is, I have a hard time visualizing what sort of dollars we're, you know, what are we talking about here? As far as what we put in now, what we invest in finding oil, in refining it, in distributing it, how does it break down when we invest in like research and development of renewables and then find ways to distribute those and then retrofit, like you're saying in Detroit, retrofit these automobile manufacturers in order to be able to make a different kind of engine. Can you compare the two?
Well, they're very large. I mean, the energy sector, if people sort of really view the energy sector to a large degree as out of sight, out of mind. I mean, we write our utility checks to the electricity companies, we pay our gas pumps, you know, but then you see periodically you get glimpses of how much money this is. I mean, TVA as an entity now is approaching $9 billion in revenue on the electric side. I think ExxonMobil, I think it was like $40 billion in recent quarterly profits. You know, we're talking enormous amounts of money, enormous amounts of money. In the government just basically, the Congress just granted, I think, $25 billion to the automobile manufacturers to basically start this process of retooling and loan credits and others to basically retool Detroit and the big three automobile manufacturers to move towards higher efficient vehicles and electric vehicles because they have to compete now in the growing green economy because we've been largely beaten by Toyota, Honda, and a lot of these other. Now, some of those are being manufactured in the United States, but the corporate entities are still largely Japanese-based automobile manufacturers. So it's a phenomenal amount of money. Barack Obama said in his policy that he wants to spend no less than $15 billion a year for 10 years to basically invest in R&D, renewable development. He also wants to partner with the private sector because one of the beauties of this is, you know, Senator Alexander was recently out in Oak Ridge and he says, look, we need another Manhattan Project on energy policy. Well, I agree with that to a certain degree, but if you really think about it, the Manhattan Project was government money for a government product. What we need is we actually need all the garages around the world. This is something that Thomas Friedman talks about, is we need to unleash the innovation of this country, not in some centralized way. I mean, the government has a role to play, but we need to unleash the private entrepreneurial innovation that this country has to really develop the alternatives. And that's what I think is going to be a government-private partnership. The government needs to set the rules, the road right. It needs to stimulate this with the proper investment in R&D and other things. But we need to set the way up where people are rewarded for their innovation to bring these things to market and help us transform market transformation, how we transform our markets to where we're now, instead of driving around in a car that gets 15 miles a gallon, we're driving around a car that gets 50 miles a gallon, trending towards 100 miles a gallon, so we can sort of say goodbye to our addiction to oil in the Middle East and to Venezuela. I mean, there's other countries that we get it from, too, that aren't friendly to us.
Will that require, I mean, I'm thinking about this as sort of a paradigm shift in, you know, thinking as opposed to getting profits from selling and distributing oil to turning around and not even thinking of it as profit, I guess, as monetary profit.
Well, I mean, you're still going to have a society that is based on people, the markets, and people making money. It's just let me put it in this terms. I believe very strongly that if I live in somebody's house, if I live in my house and I dump something in my neighbor's yard, there's something wrong with that. Okay, so there's rules that prevent that from happening. So I don't have the sort of free market to just go throw my trash over my fence to my neighbor's yard. We've got to have the rules right. There is a role for government, and I think we have seen the greatest failure of what the deregulation and that whole past 20 years has represented, where get government off our back, throw everything out, let's deregulate everything. That was why we had this absolute collapse in the financial markets. We've also been tending to do that on energy policy. We've pretty much said, let Exxon make all the money they want to. The oil companies know best. Go let them drill wherever they want to and do whatever, and not really saying, look, you need to basically be finding ways to – people don't care whether they use oil or not. What they are buying is mobility. People don't really care whether you burn coal or not. What they're buying is the services that electricity buys. We need to retool our capital markets to where the companies are providing the services people want without having to have those tied to destructive practices, carbon going in the atmosphere, drilling, spilling, whatever it is, coal burning – you know, the devastation that comes from mountaintop removal just up the road here in East Tennessee and into western West Virginia and other things like that. We need to find ways that we stimulate the markets to let people make money, but make it being green. The green you make is from this green-collar economy where you're actually bringing on these technologies. What that'll do is it is a paradigm shift, but it is such a transformative opportunity that it's going to create an enormous amount of new jobs. It's going to create new opportunities where people are trained. It's going to lift people up in ways that we haven't seen, because many of these jobs will be more labor intensive, in the sense if you're going in and doing retrofits into somebody's house where they're more energy efficiency, I mean, that's going to be a caulk gun that you're going to be going around and sealing windows. You're going to be working in people's attics. These are the kind of investments that we need to be making. We need to be training people to do that. People need to be paid to do that. And people will save money from doing that. And the energy companies are going to have to figure out how they actually get a part of that. Otherwise, there's going to be new players that come into the market that are going to be eating away at their market share. And so we'll let the market play the way it wants to play, but that set the rules of the market right so that it's not so laissez-faire that we just completely run ourselves into the ground. And that's kind of what we've just seen with the housing market. We're on the verge, and we've been doing this with the energy markets, and global warming is one of these big manifestations that's coming at us. And by the time it becomes self-evident to everybody, it's going to be too late, because much of that has a certain momentum that you can't reverse. So that's the beauty of this paradigm shift. And I think the election last night, both with Senator Obama being elected president and him having that vision and articulating that as a central piece of his economic platform and his energy and environment platform, coupled with some very key elections that came last night in like the Senate. I'll give you one example. New Mexico, Pete Domenici, who's been a long-standing Republican senator who retired this year, was just replaced by Tom Udall, whose family has a long history of being concerned about environmental issues. Pete Domenici literally single-handedly involved with even some of our southern senators, Senator Corker and Senator Alexander, but we came within one vote last year of getting a national renewable standard that would have required a certain percentage of electricity to come from renewable energy. It passed the House twice. It got stopped in the Senate by one vote. And Pete Domenici was very much involved in manipulating behind the scenes to make sure that that didn't pass. Unfortunately, Senator Alexander and Senator Corker voted the wrong way on that also. But what it did was it blocked the requirement to stimulate the market where we would have made long-term investments in wind, long-term investments in solar, long-term investments in bioenergy. And for Tennessee, All three of those are viable options that could be creating jobs. And so his removal, the fact that the Democrats have picked up now, it looks like 5 or 6 seats, increased the likelihood that we will quickly see that standard passed. It's not that the government is going to dictate exactly which technology you use. They're going to say, though, this is a target that we're going to hit. And by hitting this target, all of a sudden capital will flow, innovation will be unleashed, jobs will be created, and we'll begin to diversify our energy away from coal and nuclear and others to cleaner sources like renewable energy. These are the transformational things that we're going to see. This is why this election is so important, both to how we create jobs, how we protect the environment, and how we solve some national security issues.
Let's take a call. We have Bonnie on the line from Knoxville. Bonnie, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. First of all, I'd like to thank you for having this dialogue, and I'd like to say I completely concur with your global perspective, particularly the interdependence on oil and its relationship to our wars. But instead of thinking globally right now, I'm thinking very locally. And I was wondering if you have any perspective on sustainable housing efforts here in Knoxville, Knox County. I know a little bit about what's going on in Oak Ridge, but I'm particularly interested in home building, sustainable home building here in Knoxville. Any insights?
Bonnie, thanks for your question, and stay tuned for the answer.
So, yes, there's a number of really important things that are happening locally. I mean, first of all, there's a very active chapter of the local green building society here in of architects that are working on green building. There's a number of local builders now that are working now with TVA and when working with Oak Ridge National Lab to design what we call zero energy homes or near zero energy homes. The city of Knoxville, under Bill Haslam's leadership, working with Madeline Rojero and Madeline Weald and a fellow by the name of Tim Dimmick, who used to work for us, is now working with the city. They've been looking at how to use HUD money to make investments and get more energy efficient homes and apartments and other things in the city limits. So there's a lot of innovation going on like there. I would encourage the caller to check in with us on our website at cleanenergy.org. We can get more details to that. You know, we've been talking a lot about the transportation sector. The electric sector is a huge part of it. And the Tennessee Valley Authority is our local provider. But similar to a number of other utilities around the southeast, TVA has been struggling with, do we now go back and start building a whole new set of generation of new nuclear reactors or new coal-fired power plants or whatever it is, because up until the recession, demand was growing. People were plugging more things into the wall, big plasma TVs. Everybody's got something plugged in, and that was creating more demand. TVA was having to buy over $1 billion of power a year off system. Mm-hmm. So the board decided, hey, we're going to go out and build new plants. Well, they ran up against the fact that building a new nuclear power plant, we've seen some of the numbers come in Florida and Georgia where they've gone through Public Service Commission proceedings. They're approaching $14, $17, maybe as much as $20 billion, billion with a B, dollars, to build one of these plants now. Phenomenal amount of money. You can do an awful lot of investment in energy efficiency and renewables for that kind of money. And what TVA has done is now they've announced a major initiative to where they want to start getting back in the energy efficiency and conservation business in a big way. They were leaders in the late 70s and early 80s, but they sort of lost their way. And so to their credit now, they're starting to look at that. I think they're going to be even more influenced by the new administration to move more aggressively in that direction. And so as our caller indicated, I think we're going to see more options for people to get maybe low-interest loans to be able to buy much more energy-efficient heating and cooling systems, better investments in how you tighten up your home. I mean, right now you can go buy an automobile and you can look on the window and the EPA rating will say, how many miles to gallon? If you go to buy a new house, nobody tells you how many miles per gallon does that house get. What is its energy rating? There's a whole system out there to rate that. And so we've been strongly encouraging that we actually start to rate these homes so that people, just like when they buy a car, they can see a rating. Are they buying a Prius house or are they buying a Hummer house? Because that has financial implications down the road. And so by getting your home rated through this home energy rating service, you can go to resnet.org and you can learn about it. And you can basically see how to get your home rated. It'll find leaks in your home. It'll find ways that you can tighten your home up. It'll look at your heating and cooling system. It'll look at your appliance. It'll look at your windows. It'll give you a rating, and then you can begin to start to work down. TVA and the power distributors are offering audits. I think they need to get much more sophisticated in how they do those audits. But there's a lot of help like that coming. It is my personal belief that if we get very aggressive about that, we won't have to build those new plants. I personally believe that we are absolutely awash in energy in this country. We have so much energy, both in what we're mining and pulling out of the ground of old, you know, coal and oil and uranium and everything like that that's putting energy on the grid or putting in our tanks, but also the fact that every single day we are bathed with enough sunlight to basically supply our power needs for a year. And so there's really no reason why we aren't using the energy we have much more efficiently. And so the quickest, cheapest, best way to deal with quote-unquote the energy crisis is to get much more efficient, connect with the fact that conservation is patriotic. It's not a virtue that sort of is just great, like Cheney said early on. It is actually an indispensable part of our national policy. It should be patriotic. If you're driving a vehicle that gets 10 miles a gallon, you're not patriotic, because you're basically sending money to terrorists in the Middle East. And you need to basically be thinking about, what can I do? If you're wasting energy at your home and you're causing mountains to be blown up in West Virginia for mountaintop removal, you're destroying the integrity and the beauty of our country, and you're not leaving things to future generations. We need to regain that ethic, that commitment, that our generation is not here just to turn over all the chairs and leave everything a wreck. We want to leave this place better than we found it. I have small children. Literally, just the other day, I'm now a grandfather, believe it or not. And, you know, I'm thinking about future generations. And that was what was so, I think, compelling about last night's speech, because it wasn't just about, what can you do for me? What am I going to get out of this? But it was actually a challenge to the American people to regain those commitments to say, look, we are the greatest country on earth. Why? That doesn't mean that we just get to destroy everything. It means that we're going to provide leadership. We're going to leave the world a better place for ourselves. And we're also going to think about the rest of the world. And we're not just going to focus on ourselves. These are big, big challenges.
Well, let's go back to TVA for just a second, sure, because their campaign toward nuclear has been, it's been pretty heavy. So what kind of incentive will it take for TVA to decide to put more investment in renewables than they are currently?
Well, I think TVA, what TVA is doing right now is, quite honestly, they're just going back and recovering some old reactors that they either had running and then they had to shut down because they didn't run right, and they're trying to get them running right, or ones that were partially completed. I think the big threshold issue for us is if they actually go back in the business where they start building new from scratch. That's where, because they've got money sunk in those plants right now, and they're trying to get some of that out. And there's a certain logic to that. We don't necessarily agree with it, because we think that money could be better invested in other places. But where it really becomes, I think, a wrong and dangerous decision for the ratepayers is when they start building new reactors from scratch, because that's where you get these phenomenal price tags. Yeah. TVA is already struggling with one of the largest utility debts in the country, approaching $25 billion. They literally have a congressionally mandated cap of $30 billion, and so they've only got about $5 billion under that cap. And for them to go out and try to build a $15 or $20 billion nuclear plant is going to blow the lid off that, and I think it's going to create all kinds of problems. I don't believe we need to do that. And I think TVA's leadership is struggling with that. I think the fact that there's two board positions that are vacant right now, I think there's two more that will come vacant in the spring. The new administration is going to have an opportunity to really place some thoughtful people in those positions. And I think it's an opportunity for TVA to go in a new direction and really regain its opportunity as a living laboratory to invest in energy efficiency, because, again, that's the quickest and cheapest. They're off to a good start, but they've got a lot more to do there. And then to really invest in renewables, because as they bring on some of the wind and the bioenergy potential that we have here, I think it'll take the pressure off of having to make those huge investments in nuclear power.
Let's take another call. We have John, says he's in the car. John, are you still with us? Hello, John?
Hello?
Hello, John.
Yes.
You still holding on?
Yeah, I'm still holding on. Steve, you mentioned mountaintop removal, and that you did that after I called in. I was going to inquire whether that was an area of interest to the Southern Alliance, and I gather that it is. interesting elections here in Tennessee. It looks like the Republicans are going to organize both houses of the General Assembly. And Senator Finney, who was one of the leaders on mountaintop removal last session, was defeated in the primary. And so the legislative outlook for mountaintop removal, even though it came very close last year, is, I think, today fairly clouded. And I was just curious whether you would given any thought to that, whether that was or whether that's just a little premature in terms of strategy. But it sure is important, and it is important on many dimensions, not just the energy dimension.
Hey, thanks for the call, John, and stay tuned.
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, just so everybody understands, there is a mining technique that is used that basically to get coal relatively inexpensively in Appalachian area. We are literally blowing the tops off mountains. And going in after the coal seams with large machinery, and then not recovering it, and it literally transforms the way the mountains look. There's a phenomenal website called ilovemountains.org, I think, that basically actually uses Google Earth to document the disruption of these mountains. Appalachian Voices is an organization that does that. We have some of that activity going on in Tennessee. We have a lot of it going on just across our state borders, and that is basically to produce low-cost coal. And we need to figure out a way to take the pressure off of that. Now, there has been a lot of activity to try to ban that practice, and we're very supportive of that. We think that that is an example of, you know, using sort of short-term needs without looking at the long-term consequences. There's all kinds of devastation that comes to water quality because of this. There's people's homes and lives that are disrupted by this technique and others in Appalachia, and we need to stop it. The caller is exactly right. The state house here in Tennessee has gained some seats for the Republicans. It's unclear that the Republicans are making this a commitment, and it's going to be difficult to see what happens. But again, this gets back to, I think, the fundamental point I was making earlier is, you know, the state of Tennessee is going to have to make a very important decision. The state leadership is going to have to make a decision. Do we want to continue to swim against the tide of what is happening both in our country and internationally, where we've got to come up with ways to generate energy in a more efficient way, in a more environmentally benign way, and choose fuel sources that are not going to cause disruption of our climate? Coal, mountaintop removal coal, is a direct response to inefficient use of the energy we have. It is a very environmentally devastating in the local implications, and then once that coal is burned, it is devastating to the international climate. If we want to continue to prioritize that, and that's what the state of Tennessee wants to do, I think the state will be left behind, and I think we will miss the boat of these green-collar jobs and these big investments. If we want to say, no, we're not going to do that anymore, let's retrain people that are in that profession, let's embrace new jobs from a green-collar economy and move in a new direction. If our political leadership embraces that, Tennessee is extremely well positioned to be in a leadership position. I mean, with the resources that we have with the Tennessee Valley Authority, here with the University of Tennessee, with the Oak Ridge National Lab as one of the few national labs in the country, we have tremendous brain power here to tap into that. We're already seeing entrepreneurs come in and companies start. We've got Arizine Wind, which is a wind turbine. They actually designed the wind towers that the turbines go on in Chattanooga. We've got the largest solar manufacturer in the United States is over in Memphis at Sharp Solar, and we're seeing other industries come into this area. If we make this and then all the stuff we're doing with the bioenergy, with the cellulosic ethanol just down the road in Von Ohr and other things like that, the university mm-hmm. in DuPont are part of, if we put out a shingle that says Tennessee is going to be part of the new economy for green jobs, and we're going to transform that, and we invite industry in, and everybody pulls together in the state legislature, the governor, our federal representatives said, this is the future that we're embracing. We'll be swimming with the tide, moving in the direction instead of moving against it. And I think things like mountaintop removal will fall out of favor because it's just completely inconsistent with what we want to represent the state is all about. If you come to Tennessee, the quality of life that you see, going to be a hiking in the mountains, when you hike in the mountains and you walk around and you walk up on a mountaintop removal site, it completely ruins your hike. Let me promise you that. I've seen it. I've been there. And it's like you're going from, you know, Eden to a moonscape. You know, it's that kind of devastation. And that's not what we want to leave for our children. It's not the kind of quality of life we want. And now we need the political political leadership to make sure that that stops.
Mallory is on the line from Knoxville. Mallory, are you still there?
Yes. I'm interested in hearing Stephen's take on how we can handle some of the solutions to the problems that are generated as we retool machines, the old machines, to make hybrids and electric cars. And what do we do with all the dead batteries that are left over when the hybrid cars die? And a third question I have is, Gore's slideshow has been criticized. You know, what would you say to the naysayers about all the science and the examples of China as doing better than the U.S. on emissions?
Okay, thanks for that call, Mallory, and stay tuned for the answer.
Well, let me start with the last one first. There is no credible scientist out there that is basically denying that global warming is real and that it's happening and that there are very discernible impacts that can be seen presently. And with the International Panel on Climate Change, the international body that put out their fourth assessment, it was very clear that they said that there's over a 90% chance that this is happening and needs to be addressed. So I don't think there's really much of a scientific debate anymore. I think the question is, we still don't know the full implications of all of that because we're in uncharted territory. We've never been here before. We're experiencing carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere that have never been experienced as long as human beings have been on the planet. And so we're in an area that we don't know, and we're still learning every day about those implications. But I can promise you this, all the science that's coming in is that those implications are not good. And so it's just like taking an insurance policy out on your house. I mean, you're not betting that you're going to have a fire, but if you want to actually have some protection. We need to start making those investments not only in mitigating the impacts, but then in also figuring out ways to adapt to the impacts because they're coming, and they're coming much faster than we thought. So I think that there are people that are always going to criticize global warming, particularly people that have a financial interest in the status quo. I mean, let's think about it. When you're solving global warming, what you're doing is you're taking on some of the largest corporations that have ever been produced in the history of humankind,
yep,
whose business is carbon and putting carbon in the atmosphere. And so when you're addressing that, you're talking to ExxonMobil. You've got to quit putting carbon in the atmosphere. You're talking to Southern Company. You've got to quit putting carbon in the atmosphere. And these companies are rebelling against that because their business model is, we think we own the atmosphere and we can pollute it with no implications and nobody can tell us not to do that. And the reality is that the atmosphere belongs to all of us, and they cannot just dump, just like I was telling you earlier, I can't dump in my neighbor's yard. They can't dump in our atmosphere and then have my children and myself breathe it and then destabilize the climate. So people are going to criticize the messenger. They're going to criticize the message. But the reality is that I think people are moving beyond that. And again, there's opportunity in this crisis. And the question is whether we're going to have the foresight to basically lead and take advantage of it, or is our state and our nation going to be left behind as the rest of the world moves on?
And to think of it as opportunity.
Oh, totally.
Rather than dumping tradition or whatever.
No, it is tremendous opportunity. The other caller's question was dealing with, what do you do with things like the batteries and everything from these hybrid cars? We have to make sure that when we move into these technologies that we don't lock on to things that are going to make things worse. And yes, batteries are something we're definitely going to have to watch. One of the interesting innovative ideas that's now being promoted by one company is, you go to your car, you go to a gas station, you fill up with gas, and then you drive on. What would be the implication of actually going somewhere and somebody dropping the battery pack out of your car and putting a new battery pack in, and then they are responsible for, managing that battery pack and recharging it in off-peak times so that it can be managed. And then the consumer, just like they don't necessarily aren't responsible for managing all the gasoline, there's certain provisions and laws and are set up to do that. They basically are able to just come and interchange the battery packs, and then the battery packs are properly managed, properly maintained, and ultimately properly disposed of. I mean, I think there's some innovative ideas like that. And it's really exciting because there's just this huge opportunity that's going to manifest potentially with smart use of electric cars coupled with smart use of an electric grid, because you can literally charge your car at night, you could go to work, plug your car in at work, and then set a computer where your car would basically decide, okay, I need X number of kilowatt hours to basically get home, and if the utility comes along and says, hey, I need some extra power because the grid's surging, I'll buy that from you. And then you can sit there and actually have your car's computer interact with the utility to basically sell power back and forth. Or if you go home and the power goes out, maybe you plug your house into your car because it's been charged up or whatever. I mean, there's all these different things that all of a sudden, if we start looking at the vehicle not only as a mobility source, but also as an energy storage source. And then you can, you know, things like wind power generate more energy at night. You could charge up at night from wind power and other things. There's all these really exciting, innovative opportunities that are, I think, going to unfold. And this is why people need to quit thinking that the way we've done things in the past are necessarily the way we're going to do things in the future. Because it's just like, you know, if you go back 100 years ago at the turn of the last century and said, you know, gee whiz, would we be flying? Would we be doing these things? Would we have the internet? Nobody would have envisioned that. And I think what is possible with this new administration and with challenging people to approach things in new ways is it opens up our possibilities and it expands the opportunities. I have felt like for the last 8 years, we've been contracting and the opportunities have been going away from us. I feel now there's an opportunity to move forward. And so I think all of us need to embrace that and challenge our leaders to be bold and innovative. And this is not a time for small thinking. So I think there's real opportunities there.
It's very exciting. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see if Jim is still with us. Jim from Knoxville, are you still there?
Oh, great, Chrissy. Thank you so much for putting this program on.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for holding. Sorry to make you wait so long. What's your question?
Well, I was afraid you didn't want to talk about what I wanted to talk about because I called in so early. Dr. Smith, it's great to have you on this program. Thank you very much. You're a very articulate man. I appreciate getting to hear your opinions and knowledge on the subject. I built Solar One in Albuquerque back in the early 70s, one of the first commercial solar-powered buildings out there, and also built an aircraft that would fly with one true horsepower. It was solar-powered. And I came here to help Oak Ridge in the development of something called fluidized bed combustion. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
I demonstrated a unit for Oak Ridge that, according to their numbers, was 15 percentage points more efficient than Bull Run Steam Plant, which is our most efficient generating plant for burning coal. And I was burning high-sulfur coal in stoker form and capturing the sulfur at low temperatures so we don't generate nitrous oxides. And I became aware of the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District's problem of cleaning up Lake Superior up there. They had six of these huge wood processing plants that were poisoning Lake Superior, and they built this large fluidized bed plant up there, and they took the effluent from these six plants, each of which was much larger than the Champion plant in North Carolina, and put that through the fluidized bed along with all the municipal garbage in the area, and they don't pollute Lake Superior at all anymore. And when Knoxville tried to put that waste incinerator project in county commission, I went up there and fed them enough information that it finally got voted down because they were going to put in an old technology that was going to be outlawed in a few years, and they completely refused to discuss fluidized bed combustion. And I wondered if you could just comment on that, and I appreciate you very much. Oh, by the way, one last point.
Yes, sir.
We have the third lowest winds in America in the Tennessee Valley. It is almost impossible for you to use anything except those something on a mountaintop. And at night, our winds do not blow. And another concern, I wish Bob Edwards was on here to talk to you about this. They tell me that those 18 windmills on Buffalo Mountain up there don't really generate electricity. They just balance the load from TVA. Could you also comment on that?
Okay, Jim, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, let me take the last one first. That it's actually not accurate that we don't have wind. We have a very good wind resource in East Tennessee. Obviously, it's not as good as Texas and the Great Plains because they have a phenomenal wind resource and have been called the Saudi Arabia wind. The 18 turbines that are about 30 megawatts of wind up on Buffalo Mountain are an important first step, but they are not. They're only a small percentage of the overall generation. When TVA peaks out at say 30,000 megawatts, to only having 30 megawatts of wind up there, yeah, they're a small part of the overall mix. But we have done research. The Department of Energy has looked at this. We figure there's probably about 5,000 megawatts of wind capacity in East Tennessee, and it's actually one of the best places in our part of the country for wind development, and we think there'll be more wind developed in in East Tennessee, and I think it can be done in an environmentally benign way that's not done on the Great Smoky Mountain National Park and other things like that. That's one of my biggest criticisms with Senator Alexander is the fact that he has a really unfortunate and uneducated position on wind, and we've tried to work with him because he thinks that all the wind turbines are going to end up in the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, which is absolutely not true. And so there's tremendous opportunity for wind, but it's going to take a balanced approach because we're going to have other renewable technologies that need to be done. The caller's question on fluidized bed, I think fluidized bed is an important technology that needs to be looked at. I think there's some good advantage of it. Obviously, anytime you can make your combustion process more efficient, it helps reduce the amount of carbon that goes into the atmosphere. But I think we're going to have to really move away from just focusing on burning things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the real challenges. We've got to figure out ways to do things smarter. So I applaud the caller's efforts, and I think anytime we can find any way to make any technology more efficient, it's a positive.
Well, so we just have a few minutes left in the show. So is there something you can maybe use to inspire people? I know that that policy change, regardless of who makes it, it takes a long time to implement. So when we're talking about, you know, renewing our economy and making it a different place, what sort of time scale do you think we're talking about? I mean, if people were to, you know, just embrace this completely.
Well, think about when the United States had the challenge of World War II. You know, there and I wasn't alive at that time, but I've read a little bit about it and I've heard people talk about it. I mean, literally we went in, I think, less than a year's time from manufacturing automobiles to manufacturing the planes and the tanks that we needed. I mean, if we get on, quote unquote, a war footing, if we really mobilize the assets of this country and this nation rallies around that, we can do things at an extraordinarily fast pace. And I believe that we have the capacity to do that. It's going to require bold leadership. It's going to require real vision. And it's going to require the citizens, you know, embracing this and saying, look, we want to change. I mean, we've been talking about getting ourselves off of foreign oil for the past 30-plus years.
Yeah, as long as I've been alive.
Let's just do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's quit talking about it. Let's do it. And let's stop letting, you know, the folks that are making all the dollars at it convince us, oh, no, you don't want to do that or whatever. And you can already begin to see as the price begins to drop down, people's interest in it begins to wane. And then all of a sudden when oil comes surging back up, they're going to be saying, you know, things like drill, baby, drill and all these other kind of things. But the reality is that those are not the things that are going to get us off of our addiction on oil. Investing in energy efficient vehicles, investing in the alternatives, those are the kind of things. Using our resources that we have in a wise way, but also really getting ourselves off. So that's a big thing. The other thing is the challenge of global warming. I still honestly believe that people are not fully grasping the seriousness of that problem. And as people begin to understand that more and we begin to see what really is at stake here and what we're leaving our children and our children's children and really what we're going to experience. I mean, I've seen changes on the coastlines down in Florida when I'm down there, what's happening in places like the Everglades. You go up to Alaska and you can see the permafrost melting. You see these transformations. I mean, it kind of sounds funny, but, you know, we have this whole mythology about Santa Claus and the North Pole. I mean, quite literally, within the next 10 years, we will have summers where there is no ice in the Arctic, and people are going to be able to take boats without being icebreakers across the northern part of the globe. That is going to be change that we've never seen, and we don't fully understand that. So we've got to say, look, these are opportunities. These are things we can do. When we start turning our houses into power plants, our cars into storage units, and we start employing people at good wage jobs because they're part of the green economy, that's what it's all about. And that's what our organization is all about, and that's why we encourage people to contact us at cleanenergy.org. Be a part of this revolution. Be a part of this transformation. And let's help this new president and this new Congress bring this stuff. Let's quit talking about it and let's get out and just do it.
It is an exciting time and we do have a lot of potential. You're right, in Tennessee. You know, we have once again run out of time on Dialogue. An hour is never, ever enough. I'd very much like to thank you for being here. Stephen Smith is the executive director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Great discussion. Had a really good time. A big thank you to Greg Hill for answering the phones, handling production, and for just being an all-around good guy. And, of course, thank you to all of you who called in today to participate in today's program. If you missed part of the show or you'd like to hear it again, we'll have it up on the podcast page sometime tomorrow morning. You can find out more by visiting WUOT.org and clicking on the podcast icon. Our next dialogue is December 3rd at 1 p.m., hosted by Matt Schaefer-Powell. We hope you'll join us then. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. You've been listening to Dialogue, a production of listener-supported public radio, 91.9 FM, WUOT, Knoxville. We're a broadcast service of the University of Tennessee, changing the future today. The afternoon concert, hosted by Alan Elstrom, is coming up next. Eastern time is 2 p.m. Have a great day.